His skin is white just like a ghost. Thick Irish roots and his blonde hair. And he sounds like a Chicago super fan. A music nerd with a collection of CDs from here to there. Yes, Andy Dare is in Chicago, interviewing and barbecuing. It's the Andy Dare Show. It's the Andy Dare Show.
Welcome to the Andy Dare Show. I'm your host, Andy. Today it is episode 177. And I'm joined by Stephen Thomas Erlewin. He is a rock critic, and he has worked in such publications as AllMusic.com, Pitchfork.com, and Spin Magazine. A whole bunch of good stuff to get into with him. He has been on the show, I think, four or five times now, and we have a nice little rapport going. I guess you could say we're both music geeks, and we are obsessed with it, and it's great to talk music with somebody who knows something about it. So, the history of it all goes that my dad gifted me an All Music book in high school, I think freshman year, and the thing has stuck with me, you know, almost 20 years now. It's still sitting in my living room. The book cover has actually fallen off because of wear, but that just shows you how much I have checked out the All Music book. It's kind of my Bible, and that edition doesn't even go past 1997, but it's still nice to have around. And now if you want to check out newer stuff, you just go right to allmusic.com, and I believe they have an app for the iPhone. You just can check out a lot of cool reviews and articles based on the whole wide world of music and entertainment. And so, yeah, Erlewin, he pretty much started allmusic.com. He's gone on to do a whole bunch of other stuff. And, we're just glad to have him back on for our Year in Rock 2016 episode, where I give him my top 20 albums of the year. And yeah, we talk a whole bunch of stuff about the whole year. This one might be known as the year of the rock and roll obituary. A bunch of people passed on to the next level in 2016, and I don't want to even go into it, but that's a major point of the discussion, as well as cool new reissue box sets. That's an awesome thing. Also, just the whole what's going on with selling music. Is it happening anymore in 2017? Are you going to be buying a hard copy? Are we going back to the days of vinyl? Will you be able to find a compact disc at your Target, at your Best Buy? Will new independent record stores be popping up, or are they a thing of the past? So there's a whole bunch of stuff to discuss about 2016. We are in a really weird part of the music industry history in 2016. I think we're kind of right in the middle of something. So it's interesting to discuss it with a guy who knows a whole bunch about the topic. So I thought I'd keep my spiel short today and just give you this, I think it's about an hour-long discussion. And I want to thank everybody who's gone to andydare.com, who's clicked through the Amazon banner for their holiday purchases. Whether you're buying a new Bluetooth speaker, we had somebody buy a new Bluetooth speaker. That's pretty cool. They clicked through our site. We get to wet our beaks, and you spend zero extra dollars, zero extra cents, and it's a tip of the cap to all the hard work we put on here at the Andy Dare Show. So everybody who's checked out andydare.com, you can also check out my writing for chicagoist.com and emptylighthouse.com, whole bunch of reviews. And with this episode, we'll also be posting the top 20 list of albums. And yes, I want you to also go to radiomisfits.com. And check out my new podcast I've been working on with this guy, Pugs Moran. He is a radio veteran from Chicago. He's also spent time in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And he's the way I met him was he was an old producer of my radio mentor, Kevin Matthews. So we got along great. And basically, I just kind of egged him on to start his own podcast. He's been out of the game for a little while. So He was old friends with the guy who owns RadioMisfits.com, who's actually on the latest episode of Pugs Moran Alive. And that is the podcast title. It's Pugs Moran Alive. You can find it at RadioMisfits.com. We've been doing a weekly episode for the last 4 or 5 months now. and a lot about television, a lot about pop culture, a little bit about politics. He lets me, talk a little bit about music, and it's just a relaxed atmosphere. Pugs is one hell of a funny dude, and it's been a pleasure working with him. We just posted our year-end episode of Pugs Moran Alive, and you can also find the link for that at andydare.com. All right, without further ado, I would like to introduce my episode 177. It is the year in rock 2016 with special guest Stephen Thomas Erlewine. Welcome to the Andy Dare Show. Today it is episode 177, and I'm joined by a recurring guest, rock critic Stephen Thomas Erlewine. How you doing?
I'm doing well, Andy. How are you doing?
Doing great. And 2016, one for the books. It's been a weird, long year. It feels like it's been 20 months in 2016. The climate of the music industry is changing at a rapid rate. Beginning with early in the year, they switched the release date to Friday from Tuesday. Are you aware of this, and does this affect many people now that most people just are streaming their music via a Spotify account or an Apple Music account?
Oh, I am certainly aware of it. It certainly changed how the particulars of my job work. In terms of when deadlines are and when you receive music. And I also think that there's been a pretty good marketing push towards New Release Friday, trying to make it a little bit of an event. And it does seem like there's a big spike for listening on Friday, but that kind of fades away over the weekend from what I understand. It seems like a lot of people have their accounts hooked up at work. So in a way, it's like culminates throughout the week, and then you get the new stuff on Friday that everybody gets to sample, and
then it trickles away.
Then it trickles away, but then it probably goes back up on Monday. And I think it's also noteworthy that it has become an international release day. There are some exceptions to the rule, like I noticed like the new Leanne Rimes, I believe, is out over in the UK now, but it's not here. And there's some other acts that still get a marketing push in different territories before they come here. But the idea was to bring all of the markets together. And it seems to be working in that regard. I do find it a little, I still sort of preferred it on Tuesday, because you get away of, you can work that album the entire week. And I have yet to see any really good data on whether record retailers have liked the shift from Tuesday to Friday, because it worked well for the stores, because they're able to see if something was selling really well and then restock it on the weekend. But I think this completely pushes it to the province of streaming, which continues to be on the rise.
Yeah, I've had it from my firsthand experience at Reckless Records. They were complaining that if they sell out of something on a Friday, they have to wait till Monday to get it back in stock. Instead of having it on Tuesday, selling it out on Tuesday, they could get it Wednesday morning for everybody. So that's the one headache they're experiencing. I did see that The Weeknd still released it, his new album, on Tuesday. I don't know if he didn't get the memo or what the deal was with that. But, yeah, it seems like even if you go to a Best Buy nowadays, the CD racks are shrinking, it seems like, on a weekly basis. And But, from Tuesday to Friday, it's definitely a change. Are you still buying physical like CDs and vinyl, or are you mostly streaming now? I mean, you must listen to dozens of albums on a weekly basis. So if you were to buy all that, that would put you in the poorhouse. Am I correct?
Well, I do get serviced some things promotionally. You know, there are certain labels or PR firms that want to push their products, which is great. And so I get a fair amount through that. I will also purchase some CDs, but that tends to be things that might be a little bit harder to find. You know, some collections of obscure 60s country or something like that. And with a lot of the major releases, I will primarily listen through streaming because to me, I'm to the point of if I'm going to have a copy around, it's going to be something that I want to return to. And
sure.
With streaming, it's, if you're only going to listen to it for a few days out of the year, that does work that way. I'm under no delusions to think that anything is going to stay exclusive. I think in terms of streaming, it's always possible that catalogs can pull labels can pull catalog. They might, artists can pull catalog at some point in time. So
at their whim, right? Pretty much like Neil Young just put it back on after not having it for a while.
Right, and the rumor there, is also that now that he's in a divorce, he needs to find ways to make money. but that's exactly it. Like, it could be here for a year and it disappear, or it might be there forever. But the best thing for anybody to do if they really like something is to have either a physical product or digital download.
Exactly. Were you able to hold on to your collections throughout the years, or is it a thing of you got rid of some stuff in the 90s and you wish you wouldn't have, or did you hold on to a lot of stuff?
I've held on to most of the stuff that really made a difference to me. I mean, it's inevitable if you're moving across the country a few times and moving from house to house, you might prune the collection some, and I don't really mind that. Because
it's life; it happens.
It's life; it happens, and you can always go back out and find something again.
Exactly. Now I go to Goodwill and I'll buy a stack of CDs, 20 CDs for $20, and some rare stuff in there actually in good condition. So you're gonna still be able to find it, you know.
This really is a great time to go to Goodwill or record stores to get used CDs because that's a fallow market. Everybody's been offloading them and have been concentrating on picking up vinyl. And so you might still be able to find some really great stuff. And as you said, like some rare stuff at Goodwill. So I highly recommend attempting that.
Yeah, and speaking of the vinyl resurgence, this is a new thing that we've experienced at our record store this year, is that a lot of the new releases are, the vinyl versions are now coming out 6 weeks later. And that kind of seems like a bummer for any big music fan when something drops and you have to wait 6 weeks to get the new Rolling Stones Blue and Lonesome on vinyl because there's such a demand and such a press on the record plants. I guess they're not opening new record plants, but the demand is going up, and they're really having trouble filling all the demands. So I think that's something interesting. Maybe that might be a new market for somebody to go into, is to create more record pressing plants.
Yeah, I think the thing with that is that it is an expensive thing to do, and that it's very difficult to know how long that market's going to be, and so be viable. So you're sort of at this thing where, at this place where the industry could sustain another pressing plant, because from what I understand, everybody's still jammed, but it's hard to tell whether it's worth the expense to really invest in it.
If it'll
also
last.
I think that, right. And I think part of that delay for these titles is that it's that everything is jammed, and some of the new titles, they're probably pressing up too many weird exclusives for a record store day that people don't really want, like, pressings of the Clueless or Empire Records soundtracks. Right, and that eats up the space for something like the Stones on vinyl, which will sell very well for a very long time.
Exactly. And plus the prices have gone up on new vinyl as well. You're talking $30 to $40. And I did see that the Blue and Lonesome, that would fit on one record, but it's a double. just so that they could squeeze $40 out of you. Yeah, it's definitely a double. Yeah.
It's not even that long.
No, that's what we're saying.
Of a record. I mean, are each of them pressed on 45 RPMs?
Yeah, we had all these conspiracy theories about what it's all about, why they stretched it that way. But kind of like the Metallica, the double album that could fit on one disc as well. It just looks cooler as a double album. It's more metal or something. I don't know.
I can sort of understand it with the Metallica because having it separated as a double album brings to mind Injustice for All. And
sure.
Sort of gives it a different feel for that, but that's ridiculous. I was looking through an audiophile catalog last week and saw that there seems to be a trend of like repressing old Santana albums at a single album is four LPs with at 45 RPM.
Okay.
I have not seen any sign of this before, and to me, it just seems maddening. Like, you get to listen to 2-3 songs, and then you have to flip it over, and that's just... I can't imagine that the sound is that much better, but I'm sure that you could go on some audiophile forum.
And Santana's thinking about his audience are baby boomers that are just getting their government money and have a lot of disposable income, so...
I'm sure that's true. Yeah.
And here's the thing that is no fun streaming that you need a physical form of. I was reading Annie Zaleski's take on the box sets of the year. A box set, you still need the real article. You need to have that in your hand and read through the liner notes and treat it with care and put it on the shelf. And it's always a nice thing. That's one thing that and that's the most expensive thing, but you still need to have the physical thing. Am I correct with that still?
Yes and no. I feel like there's a great range of opinions here, and I really like Annie's piece. I think she's a great critic. But some of this stuff actually does show up on streaming services. Like I've been surprised by how many of the big box sets eventually get parceled out onto streaming, and in a way you can sample there and sort of figure out whether the David Bowie box is really worthwhile. I think like that one has some really great things, and the packaging is beautiful. And I think that if you are a really big fan, that's definitely the way to go. And then you get something like the huge Pink Floyd box, the early years,
sure.
Which comes with 11 or 12 CDs, and then a bunch of Blu-rays and DVDs that have video content to it, and then there's a lot of replicas of posters. And
is it like $500 or something?
It is like $550, and it is beautiful, and it's gorgeous, and it's a really nice, immersive experience. But I'm not sure how many people can really afford $550, you know, and it, that too is going to be issued as a series of individual discs over the course of the next year.
It'll be broken
and
up.
So
okay.
It'll be broken up. There's only going to be one segment that is exclusive to the box, and that's not so bad. And then something like the Bob Dylan 1966 live recordings is actually pretty cheap, all things considered. Like, it's about 120 for 30 discs. But there's a fine line between something that is a really worthwhile archival dig and then something that is just put out there to get fans to empty out their wallets one more time. And it's like the Floyd at that price tag, I can see why it can be seen like milking the audience, but it really is well produced all the way through.
And I could see like a genre that's outside of your comfort zone, like Sun Ra just released a box set, and I'm not too super familiar with his work, so I stream some of that stuff. Because I'm not really ready to run out to the store and buy a Sun Ra box set, but
oh no,
yeah, or Philip Glass too. But his is not streaming. That's something that's one of those box sets that seem really worth it. At Amazon, it's $89, and it's something like 26 discs. So
and if you're serious at that, that's really worthwhile. The weird thing is that we're also getting been having the opposite phenomenon where you can like buy all of the Cars albums for $40.
Yeah.
You know, or maybe even $20. And that's actually a nice phenomenon as well. So
I love those complete works box sets where they take a band and they just do every album. That's always a satisfying thing. Like the Beatles, mono and stereo, you know?
Yep. And that's another well-produced set. I think that my problem with really expensive box sets tends to be for something that's either like album specific, because those are usually around $100 and there's going to be vinyl and
sure.
CD and demos. And it's like, I feel like that's puffed up a little bit more.
Too much stuff.
And it's also too much stuff and too narrow of a focus. And or like something like this, the new Last Waltz box that just came out, it doesn't really add anything to the previous box apart from a new book, you know, which is nice, but you know,
if you got the last one, you don't need this one.
Yeah. Pretty much. Yeah. And so those, and maybe there's also licensing reasons for that, but it's chances are it's just tied into, you know, the anniversary, 40th anniversary.
Yeah, my favorite box set reissue, whatever you want to call it, it's from a band that I was never even really a big fan of, but it totally opened my eyes to what they were in the beginning, and that's White Zombies' It Came From NYC box set. It's a three discs, covers their 80s catalog, and it shows them as a New York art rock band, similar to Sonic Youth or something like that. And it's totally not the, you know, the horror flick, you know, dumb metal band that they became. It's actually something pretty different. And they did a beautiful job on that. Rob Zombie really, I don't think, had any part in it. It was from the Numero group. They pretty much put it out, and the other members of White Zombie got together. But it's something to check out if you're any fan of that New York kind of art rock drone noise sound, you know.
I also like that for that very reason. Like it's helping to fill out the reputation, and that's an area of the band that is not well known, and it's a gorgeously produced set, and it's well researched, great liner notes, and it's not a cash-in, you know.
No,
it's definitely, and it'll open your eyes.
Yeah, and I asked Rob for an interview about that, and I don't think he has any part of it. He's more intent on doing his haunted house, which I'm sure he's raking in the dough with. But an interesting early look.
Yeah, there's a lot more money, I bet. Yeah.
Very true. And another good remastered reissue thing, Tad. The grunge rock band Tad released their first three projects on Sub Pop. And with the first three albums, you're getting Jack Endino, Steve Albini, and Butch Vig, kind of like the holy triumvirate of indie rock from the late 80s. So that's definitely something worth checking out, with a nice, beautiful book with interviews and cool outtakes and stuff like that. Have you checked that one out?
I have not seen those, but my friend and colleague Mark Deming has, and he was also very, very positive on that, and I know that they'll be making the All Music list of reissues.
Oh, very cool.
For 2016.
Nice, and you've been contributing to Pitchfork now. I've seen your stuff in Spin as well. You're making the rounds. That's pretty awesome. How did you start the relationship with Pitchfork?
Basically, I contacted a couple of people that I knew there and just started with wanting to review the Isley Brothers box in depth, and just started a nice working relationship with them. It's get to write in a different format than I do at All Music TiVo, and so it's a fun challenge for me.
So you find something that you're interested, you write it first, or do you pitch it first and then you go ahead and you do the full article?
It depends. It depends on the thing. Like I also did a piece on reissues for Pitchfork earlier in this year, and that would be something that I pitched, and you know,
awesome.
So it worked that way.
Yeah. Very cool. And 2016 will forever go in the books as the year of the rock and roll death. Geez, I think over 15 big names all entered the next level in 2016, starting with David Bowie, Prince, Glenn Frey, Leon Russell. Just last week we had Greg Lake. Was there any one of these that hit you super hard? I think Bowie's was kind of just the whole surprise of it all kind of hit everybody off guard, and that was kind of an interesting last finale for Bowie, kind of this surprised.
Well, sure, demise. Yeah, because yeah. No, right, it was not publicized that he was ill, and it came just days after Black Star's release, so the whole thing had, and that. Having them come back to back was an impression that it was almost orchestrated as a farewell, which of course it wasn't, but it gives a sense of theatricality that's actually quite welcome. And I think that after his death, it was very easy to go back through his catalog and notice that he was not obscuring his emotions, which was usually like a knock against him, that he was all artifice, but it's really easy to go back and look at how open he was in addressing where he was emotionally throughout his career. And I think that if you haven't read Chris O'Leary's Pushing Ahead of the Dame blog, or and he's also Bowie Songs on Twitter, it's really remarkable close reading of David Bowie's entire catalog. And it also has the first of two parts of Bowie analysis out as a book. It's called Rebel Rebel. So cool. Bowie, of course, I think he's fantastic, and I thoroughly recommend him to you and all your listeners. And Bowie hit me hard, as did Prince, because Prince, of course, was another surprise. I remember just a week or two before the death, there one plane landed, I believe, in Chicago on his way home to Minneapolis. There were rumors that he was dead, and then to actually have it confirmed about 2 weeks later is just
very shocking.
It's a real thing, right? It's very shocking, and it was also the kind of thing where he seemed to be entering some sort of nice groove in the last couple of years. He's like, I liked the Third Eye Girl band, and so that's a shame. And he was also somebody that you could imagine making great music until he was 70, so it's really too bad. And I also was hit really hard by Merle Haggard's passing, much older, and you also knew that he was ailing, but I think that he, along with Bowie and Prince, is one of the greats of the 20th century that really
changed the face of country music. Yeah.
Yeah, and I have to say, we've had a lot this year, and I'm afraid that it's not going to stop. I feel like this is all just part of a generational shift, and over the next couple of years, we're probably going to have a lot of legends pass away, and so we should steel ourselves for that.
Yeah,
and appreciate them when they're here. If you know, if Willie Nelson's playing your town, go see Willie Nelson.
Very true. Yeah.
So.
Enjoy them while they're here. And yes, I think that's a beautiful part to go out on. We will be right back after this with Tom Erlewine. This episode of the Andy Dare Show is brought to you in part by Uncle Bub's award-winning barbecue in Westmont, Illinois. Family-owned and operated since 1997, Uncle Bub's is the real deal barbecue. A family-friendly restaurant open 7 days a week. Also, it's a full-service catering company doing weddings, pig roasts, luau's, grill packages, you name it. They have a friendly, helpful staff that will make sure that your party goes off without a hitch. Call them at 630-493-9000. Visit them at 132 South Cass Avenue in Westmount, Illinois, and UncleBubs.com. This episode of the Andy Dare Show is brought to you in part by Record Utopia, a music lover's dream with thousands of vinyl records, musical instruments, and sound gear. They buy, sell, and trade. Give them a call at 630-963-1957. Visit them in Westmont, Illinois at 309 West Ogden Avenue, on the web at recordutopia.com. It's always a good, relaxed atmosphere. Check them out. Record Utopia.
Hey, yo. Jay Pawks here. I know you're keeping a lock to the Dare Network for all your podcast needs, whether that's the Andy Dare Show, the Tyler Kale Show, Jesse Unplugged, or the smooth, sultry tones of me, the Jay Porks Podcast. You keep it locked to andydarer.com all throughout 2016 for all the luscious podcast action.
Hello.
All right. Yeah, we're good. Let me start it up again. All right, we are back with Tom Erlewine. We are wrapping up the year in rock, 2016. Been a crazy year. I have got my top 20 list, and you can check out yours over at your website. What's that?
Let's see. The top 20 will be going up at allmusic.com on Wednesday, and I also have a Tumblr that you can see linked off of my Twitter, which is Sterling, S-T-E-R-L-E-W-I-N-E,
awesome.
Twitter, and I believe that's my Tumblr as well.
Very cool. All right, so yeah, I'm going to do 20 through 10. We'll go pretty quick on those, and then I'll do my top 10 a little bit in more depth. Number 20, this is funny. I rode the bike a lot this summer and rode over 100 miles through forest preserves and stuff like that, and my soundtrack for a good 85% of it. This is kind of embarrassing, actually. This is a coming out party for me, but Blink-182's California album.
Really?
Yes. Tom DeLonge has left the group, and in his place, we've got Matt Skiba from the Alkaline Trio, which is a pretty big name here in Chicago. Pretty good goth punk, pop punk sound. And with Tom DeLonge's absence, we have a very it's like a songwriting clinic. Mark Hoppus sounds great. The whole songwriting is actually very sharp, and it's one of those albums that touches on what they used to do, but with a lot less of the toilet humor that they're known for throughout the 90s and early 2000s. So it's a little bit more mature, but it's still got that pretty hard-hitting punk pop sound with some actually great songwriting, I have to admit. So did you ever hear that one?
I have not heard that one. I did not review it this year, so I'm. But you've piqued my interest.
Interesting. So number 19, the aforementioned Metallica with Hardwired ... to Self-Destruct. The version I have is a 3-CD chunky box with the third CD being a kind of a revisited garage incorporated with a medley approaching Rainbow's Rising album, which is super cool. And then a full live set at Rasputin Records in California. And the guys sound great on the live set. The live set only takes songs off of their first two albums, so it's a pretty raw sound. And, yeah, the album itself is kind of a return to their roots. Doesn't sound anything like Saint Anger, thank God. The drums sound great. The guitars sound great. Kind of interesting that Kirk Hammett lost all of his notes for the album with his stolen iPhone, so he has zero songwriting credits. Yeah.
It still seems strange to me that he has no credits, considering that phone, I thought, disappeared a while ago, and it seemed like they could have found a way to get songs on there. So it just goes back into those weird intrapersonal dynamics of Metallica, which is one of the reasons they're so fascinating.
That's true. And I asked my buddy, I go, he's soloing all over the thing. Doesn't that mean he's writing some of it? He goes, nope, that's not writing. Soloing is not writing.
I'm sure lead guitarists would disagree with you.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, I don't know. So an interesting sound. Nevertheless, check it out. Number 18, Neil Young with The Promise of the Real with their Earth double live album. And to your dismay, I'm also adding on Peace Trail, which I know you're pretty disappointed in.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of that one, but I do like Earth. I thought that Earth is Promise of the Real has revitalized Neil to an extent. I liked last year's Monsanto years and I like the way that he's playing with it. With Peace Trail, to me, it feels like he wrote the songs as he was going along. But I do think the My Robot song is fascinatingly bizarre.
And John Oakes, there's some just really weird left brain thinking on that. But yeah, I love The Promise of the Real. I think it's akin to Mirror Ball when Neil found Pearl Jam. Youthful energy bringing Neil back to what he does best. Right?
Yeah.
All right, number 17, kind of underwhelmed by this one, but Chicago band Wilco with their album called Schmilko. Jokey album title, Nod and a Wink to Harry Nilsson aside. It's kind of like a back porch strum along album. It's kind of a hazy autumnal dark album kind of, but it's interesting in its own way. It didn't catch me like Star Wars caught me last year. I thought that was kind of the more powerful article. How about you? Did you enjoy it?
This one I haven't gotten around to. I had a really busy fall, so I missed it, but I've gathered that's the general impression people have had over this one, that they don't like it nearly as much as Star Wars, which I did like.
Nils Klein, which is their secret weapon of a hotshot jazzy lead guitarist, is super underutilized on the album. You barely even hear the guy at all, which is part of the Wilco thing, is when they get in like wrapped up in their guitar circles and just, you know, solo for 3 minutes with Nils Klein, Jeff Tweedy, and the other guy. And it's something that's missing on the new album. But it's Wilco, and they're you know, Chicago Suns. We really enjoy them over here, so I'll put them on there. And number 16, taking it all the way to Scotland, Teenage Fan Club with their album Here. The thing I like about Teenage Fan Club is the three singer-songwriter triumvirate, which is an interesting thing, which I had Norman Blake on the show and we discussed it. That's a very rare thing. I mean, you had the Beatles doing it. You have a couple other bands, but it's pretty rare. And I
Sloan
said,
might have it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Sloan. Okay. And I asked, why did you do it that way? And he says, oh, because we're lazy. We only want to write four songs a piece for an album, and then we have an album. So everybody just write four songs, we're good. Which you can, instead of writing 12, you can write four. So. But yeah, those harmonies are just gorgeous, and that band has never changed really. I mean, they had that one little angsty album called 13, you know, shrugging away the critics' praise and everything. But they're pretty much still the same band that did Bandwagon-esque, you know.
Mm-hmm.
All right, number 15. I don't even know if you would know this band. They're local, or they grew up around the Chicagoland area, and now they're based in New York City. Kleenex Girl Wonder. Does that ring a bell?
I've listened to them before, but I have not heard this one.
Oh, okay.
They're a good band.
Yeah, it's called the Comedy Album. It is a double album, really funny, but really self-deprecating. The guy's name is Graham Smith, and he's the singer-songwriter. He's kind of the genius of the group, and just a totally unique sound. Doesn't sound like the Pumpkins, doesn't sound like Nirvana, doesn't sound like Cheap Trick, but totally its own original document, which is something that's rare to say in 2016. So highly recommended. He's a friend of the show as well. All right, number 14. The guy cut off his trademark haircut, has a new look. He's still singing his Lothario, drugged out R&B, soul man, you know, EDM-ish stuff. The Weeknd with Starboy. I've heard a lot of mixed reviews. It's a little too long. It's got like 20 tracks, but the couple tracks with Daft Punk are super revitalizing, and he keeps kind of working on his sound and just polishing it up, and it's really becoming something totally different than what he started with, and I kind of respect him for that. I mean, he's not doing the deep house sides that he started with in 2011, a mere 4 years ago, 5 years ago. Now he's trying to become the next Michael Jackson, and You gotta enjoy the balls on the guy to actually try to become the next world's pop superstar, no matter what he's talking about or how dark the lyrical subject matter is. Are you a fan?
I like singles. I have some problems with his, like, I find him kind of standoffish as a personality, and so that can keep me at a distance sometime, and I have not heard this one yet. Because it just came out like last week or so, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, like I like the Can't Feel My Face, and I like that kind of like 80s retro vibe that he can do.
There is a lyric on the album about him being on the Teen Choice Award stage and receiving a reward for a song about doing cocaine, which is a weird little, you know, he's caught in between two worlds there, winning the Teen Choice Award and then partying. So interesting. I like the two sides when somebody's kind of tortured like that. That's kind of an interesting take. All right, number 13, the aforementioned Rolling Stones with Blue and Lonesome, kind of a surprise release. I mean, we heard about this maybe 2 months ago at the most. This was rumored. I know it started out of sessions for a brand new original album from the Stones, and finally they got caught. They got stuck in a rut, and just as Keith said, let's jam on an old blues song that we used to do as kids, and they did, and then they just kept going and had enough to do a full album.
And I'm really glad that they did something like this because it's been a while since we've heard them just be able to play as a band together.
Sure.
And I think that's one of the really when they've been in the studio, I agree with Keith that they can overthink what they do, and so it's really nice to hear them. I'm sorry about the dog.
It's all good. It's Don Was, right? Don Was is the producer with the Glimmer
Don
Twins.
Don Was there. And the other thing that I like about this is that it was not obvious selections, but it's also not really trying to show that they're really crate diggers. It's songs that really showcase the band, and in particular, Jagger. Jagger is fantastic on it.
Yeah, the blues harp sounds amazing.
Yeah,
I like the no frills production on the thing, and as you said, I'm so glad they didn't try to tackle Manish Boy or Sweet Home Chicago or one of those. They went with a little bit deeper without being completely obscure sides from the blues past. But yes, as you said, I love how it was a no frills production, and the band sounds great. I'm just waiting for them to make that bassist a member, right?
Exactly. I don't think it's gonna happen. I think that. I had a discussion on my Facebook wall a couple weeks ago about that, and some people pointed out there might be contractual reasons that we can't even think of. Like, if he becomes a full member, does he have to, you know, get increased royalties rates?
Yeah.
But it also is kind of weird that he's been playing with them for almost as long as Bill Wyman did.
When did he start? Do you know? Is it like Voodoo Lounge or...?
It was Voodoo Lounge, so it's like about 22 years at this point. And it would be nice just to see him in pictures at some point, maybe.
Live, they don't have him performing behind an amplifier, do they? That would be really bad.
No.
All right, so number 12, another obituary, Leonard Cohen with You Want It Darker. I got this album the day it came out, and... We all read the article where he's kind of calling his death. You know, he's 82, he's frail, he's doing a lot of the vocals for the album in his medical chair in his living room. His son is producing, and it doesn't quite hit it out of the park like Black Star does, because it's so on the nose about his death. It's like the lyrics could pretty much be, I'm dying, this is my final album, blah, all that stuff. It doesn't really allude to it too much, doesn't shade it at all. But at the same point, it's going to be sad to never get another emission from Leonard Cohen. You know, the guy he's scarier than most death metal bands with just whispering over a couple piano chords. You know, he had so much power with so little, right?
Right. And it's also, at a certain point, I realized that the cheapness of some of the synth sounds was certainly a deliberate choice on his part, and it helps accentuate the song and the lyric. There's a nice contrast between that kind of the sound that he gets, like that sparseness that really helps push him toward the forefront.
Yeah, and I wish there was a little bit more humor. I always thought he was actually a very funny guy. Even back to the 60s, some of that stuff has a lot of dark humor to it. And, I mean, I can tell if he's on his way out, you're not going to be really wanting to crack too many jokes. But You Want It Darker definitely hit a note in 2016. It just couldn't put it too high up just because there's so much good stuff to talk about. All right, number 11, another old band comes back. This time they've got Paz LaChantaigne. As their bassist, the first time they actually had a full-time bassist since Kim Deal, the Pixies with Head Carrier. I find this to be a complete joy to listen to. Frank Black is completely re-energized, not trying to write the next Doolittle, not trying to make a punky, edgy thing like some of his solo stuff, doing what they do best, catchy, powerful, alternative college rock. And did you get to hear this one?
I think it's a lot better than Indy Cindy.
Way better.
It feels like they're it's just kind of settling into a new phase. It sort of feels like he's conjoined the Catholics and the Pixies.
Sure.
So it's sort of a
he sounds happy and content. And yeah, as you said, Indy Cindy was just a collection of three EPs, and this is the first time they actually sat down and did a full album together. So
yeah.
All right, so number 10, the I Don't Cares with Wild Stab. This was a great album, came out of nowhere. Paul Westerberg, Juliana Hatfield, they have charisma coming out the ass. I heard it described as Donny and Marie Osmond with switchblades. That was interesting. He did a great interview with Peter Wolf right as the album came out. Got to love Paul Westerberg, not just doing another solo album, not trying to re-spark the energy he had with the Replacements. This sounds like neither, and it sounds like both at the same time. And Juliana Hatfield, got to love her energy is not super felt throughout everything, but when it matters, it's definitely it hits home. And I think they have an undeniable charisma together.
I also think that if it wasn't for Juliana, that this album may never have gotten out there. So even if she's not heard through harmonies, per se, I think that she's helps push Westerberg out the door with the record. And I think this is a better album than we ever would have gotten from a reunited Replacements. And it's just, it really it captures a lot of what's great about Paul, both through the raggedness and also some consideration, and it's emotional and it's really hooky, and it's a great record.
Easily his best since 14 Songs, I'd say. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right, number 9.
It also feels more like the Replacements than 14 Songs does too.
Yeah, you're right. It's got that punky energy.
Without sounding like the Replacements. So.
Yeah, and it's funny because he sounded older on like Don't Tell a Soul than he does now, which is weird.
Yeah. Right? Yep.
All right, so number 9, Chicago Sweetheart, the new name in rap music. I heard this guy has one employee. He does not. He's still unsigned. He does not have a record label he has to pay off. Chance the Rapper with Coloring Book. One of those things that didn't even drop on CD, or I think it maybe came out on vinyl, but it was pretty much just a mixtape. But it finds this kid totally bringing a different sense of rap music from Chicago, whereas the past couple years you've had this new uber violent, uber young, terrible, just deadly sound with this drill rap that's coming out of the South Side. And Chance is the kid that you could bring to Thanksgiving and your grandma would love him. You know, he's got that good personality about him. You can tell he's got a huge future ahead of him. He's steeped in the gospel stylings of the South Side, and yet he's also aware of his surroundings. So I think Kanye put him on earlier this year on The Life of Pablo, and he hit it out of the park with Coloring Book. And the weird thing is, right now he says he's recording his debut album. So sky's the limit for that kid. Have you heard much of his stuff?
I like what I've heard, and I haven't heard the full thing yet, but I know I'm going to like it once I actually get around to listening.
Yeah, and especially he's just what the city needs in this time of ultra violence and all that stuff. We need something positive here. Okay, so number 8. They came back in 2007. I know this is one of your favorite reunited bands that had a second life that continue to release new music, and it's increasingly awesome as the years go on. Dinosaur Jr. with Give a Glimpse of What You're Not. This is probably my favorite of the reunion. This is the fourth of the reunion albums. This is my favorite. It just sounds super raw. It condenses everything they're known for into a super palatable album, 12 songs. How did you feel about it?
Oh, it's fantastic. It's either this or beyond the first reunion, that's my favorite of the latter day albums for me. But it's amazing how vital they sound without doing anything explicitly different. There's a little, like, little flourishes around there, but they just sound massive, and the songwriting from both Jay and Lou is great. And I saw them live on this tour, and they're fantastic. Again, it's one of the great rock reunions ever.
Yeah, see what can happen when you make nice and you just go for the gold instead of bickering and just doing your own thing. It's cool that they all put everything aside and realize, hey, this is what brought us to the party in, you know, 1985. Lou, I was talking to Lou. He was out on a solo tour to, like, New Zealand and Australia earlier this year with just a ukulele or just an acoustic guitar. That's all he said. And I was like, yeah, isn't that nice? You don't have to have roadies and stuff. I couldn't afford roadies. Dinosaur Jr. can afford roadies. That's what he told me.
So I believe that's true.
Yeah. So just an awesome sound. Catch them live if you want to just get your face melted. Number seven. This one is the critic's darling, and it's weird to see that Solange. I hope that's how you pronounce it. Solange Knowles
is now
beating her sister in a lot of these year-end charts, and I mean, I need to go check that album out if it's really causing that many waves. But Beyonce's Lemonade kind of hit a chord with it. You know, gangsters liked it, the soccer moms liked it, alternative rock guys liked it, Jack White's on the thing. The only weird thing was that it was about Jay-Z cheating on her, and that was the whole big reason to go check out the album. But then at the end of the album, doesn't she just take him back because she loves him so much? It's kind of like an antithesis of the strong womanhood that Beyonce's known for with all these young women, right? It seems like your man can cheat on you and do some bad stuff, but at the end of the day, if you love him, you'll take him back, which I don't know is a super great sentiment to teach the kids. But hell, the music was gorgeous, and it approached, you know, a dozen different styles on a dozen different songs.
I'm also a big fan, and I'm also of the record because I think that it's very smartly done. It follows through its storyline very well. And the songs are really strong, and she also purposely tries a bunch of different styles out. Like, as you said, Jack White's on there, and you also have Daddy Problems, where it goes for country. And I think that's one of the reasons that feels so audacious, and it also is very tied to the political moment in time, which is also really smart and sharp. And there's part of me that also wonders, well, did Jay-Z actually cheat on her or not? It doesn't really matter in a sense, because, you know, that storyline's out in the air. And so she gets to create an actual piece of art out of the idea of it. And there's a storyline through there. I think it's a lot better than Solange. I think that Solange is, I saw Michelangelo Matos call it, it's a tone poem. There's a tone, and she reads a poem over it.
Wow, okay. It's like Yoko or something?
Because I think that Solange is, it's more of a vibe, and the art is pushed toward the forefront, and so I can see why Spin and Pitchfork and NPR push it forward, because it's an interesting album, but I think Lemonade's a better record in every respect.
I haven't heard it, but I think I agree with what you're saying there. Okay, number six, the fourth self-titled album from Weezer. I thought that his songwriting has actually improved these last couple years. I think he's going back to his Blue Album roots while still honing his songwriting style. I asked Billy Corgan, actually, if he likes Rivers Cuomo. He says that guy keeps getting better with every album after the one, the Beverly Hills song. That was his nadir, and then he slowly climbed back, and he just keeps getting better with everything. Are you a fan of the album?
I am, and I find it fascinating that Billy Corgan said that. And I like hearing things like that, because I think that songwriters view other songwriters differently than just say a casual
Yeah, because they couldn't be any different of critic. Songwriters, Rivers Cuomo and Billy Corgan, but he can see when somebody's challenging himself with new material that's different, but at the same time still stays true to his original mission plan.
Yeah, and I liked hearing the stories about the construction of this album, of how he like got onto Tinder to actually learn stories about how people are living now. And I think that he's a very serious songwriter in a sense. I know that he's written a lot of goofy songs in some way, but he really concentrates on the craft of the song. That's something that I like about it. And I thought that this record was a really strong one.
He was the first American alt rocker to embrace Brian Wilson in the early 90s. That wasn't a very style de jure in the early 90s with the grunge phenomenon.
It came to a forefront in the late 90s when things like the High Llamas started.
Elephant Six stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
But he was the first one that he would actually was into the harmonies and the candy-coated harmonies back in the day when that wasn't really very cool in 1994. But he stuck with it when other bands are long gone, and it's good to see him still having success. Number five, another veteran band. This was an interesting thing. I think it was Father's Day 2016. We got the word that Radiohead was releasing a new album. I believe the day before they said it. And coming out on a Sunday, which was weird, and then I'm going to dinner at my family's house, and I look at my phone on Apple Music, and there is a brand new Radiohead album on my phone. I didn't have to do anything. I just opened an app. That's kind of like a little shell shock. But great album, gorgeous music. Burn the Witch might be my favorite thing Tom York has done since OK Computer. The whole album doesn't quite hit the high of that, but it sustains a mood throughout the whole thing, and it never breaks away from it. And it's a very warm sounding album, and I'm a total fan. So I haven't seen them live since 1998. I don't know what they're doing live really anymore. But it's just good to see that they're still providing quality soundtracks for the apocalypse, pretty much.
It's also interesting, like, I was sure that the alphabetical order was some sort of basically just like a gimmick, but it actually, the sequencing of the album really works, and it builds to True Love Waits, and it's a very strong record.
Yeah, True Love Waits, that's definitely mana for any longtime Radiohead fan to hear that actually flushed out in the studio. Yes, big fan of that. Number four, we're just talking about how the last album was a weird release. This is the weirdest release of my lifetime, 33 years into my life. Kanye West, The Life of Pablo, we had it rumored to come out. He was going to unveil it at Madison Square Garden. Everybody's tuning in to get the new album. He doesn't release the album. Everybody goes home. Then the next day, it's still not coming out. I'm looking on there's websites that tell you what has leaked, and the release date has come and gone, and it has not leaked yet, and that was another weird thing to see in 2016. The album, not one of his best, not The College Dropout, not even 808 and Heartbreak, or Graduation, but it's sprawling, it's huge, it tries everything, it fails quite a bit, which is something that I can enjoy from time to time. Just full of pathos, full of weird imagery, and it seems like it sent them to the psychiatric ward about a couple weeks ago, something to do with it. Supporting Trump, all this weird stuff, talking about Jay-Z and Beyonce needs to talk to him, all this weird stuff surrounding it 8 months later, 9 months later. But the album is something rewarding. This is also a big thing for me because this is the first major release that was not on compact disc. Are you a fan?
I find it intriguing, and there are things that I really like on the album. Of course, Ultralight Beam is really excellent. I've found that the mangledness of the release was a bit off-putting for me because I understand how an artist wants to keep tweaking something and revising it. I mean, look what George Lucas did with the Star Wars films.
Sure.
But I found it difficult to like find what the finished product was for Life of Pablo. And so as he, you know, if he's going to continue to fix waves, I'm just going to wait until it's fixed.
Yeah, I didn't like that. And you have to release something that's finished. You can't keep tweaking something. You, like, the Beatles aren't going back and tweaking Abbey Road 40 years later. You have to give the people something finished. Yeah.
Yeah, there's. I mean, I understand the impulse, but for me as an audience, I found it a little bit off-putting to not know what the finished product was.
Yeah, very strange release, even from the title, The Life of Pablo. Very weird. Very weird year for Kanye West. Wish him well, though. We'll see what happens. Number three, Iggy Pop with Post-Pop Depression. He finds Josh Homme and a couple other guys and totally revitalizes his sound, totally has chemistry with these, with this new generation. And a year after we, or the same year we lose Bowie, we get a gorgeous, dark entry into Iggy Pop's solo catalog and something that I loved. How about yourself?
Oh, I think it's really great. And I thought that Josh Homme does a really nice job of pushing Iggy in a certain way without overwhelming Iggy. Like, it's not, you definitely get some of Josh's signature guitar sounds, but he's not imprinting his personality on it. And Iggy sounds fantastic. And if this winds up being a farewell album from Iggy, it's a great way to go.
Yeah, it's weird. Like, back in 2003, Iggy had that Skull Ring album where he kind of tapped into the next generation by working with, like, Green Day, with Peaches, with Sum 41, all these things. But it was a mangled mess of an album, and it didn't have any continued sound about it. This is one continued sound. And, yeah, it proves that Josh Homme is not only a great songwriter, but can produce and lead a band, which is a super important thing. And maybe, I don't think, I think this might actually call for a sequel. We'll see what happens with that. All right, number two. Another one that came out of nowhere, another album that dealt with loss of a member, A Tribe Called Quest with We Got It From Here, Thank You For Your Service. This, what they did this perfectly. Q-Tip produced the thing. Just sounds like 1993. It's of the moment, but it doesn't sound like anything that's in the urban top 20. There's no auto-tuning. There's no pans to drugs, sex, violence, all that stuff. It's Q-Tip and company doing what they do best, and so glad to see that they were able to put this out. Are you a fan?
This is the record that just keeps inching up in my list, and it's really emotional and political and tied into the moment without feeling ever like it's pandering over like sounds of the time. It's a remarkable piece of work.
And you can tell that Fife Dog was alive for most of the recording, because it's not, you know, 12 tributes to Fife Dog. It's just your,
exactly.
It's just a next Tribe Called Quest, which is even another reason why I liked it better. So,
I totally agree.
And good to hear Busta Rhymes back with the group that brought him to the picture, you know, almost 30 years ago. Yeah.
He sounds so good on it, too.
Very awesome. So that leaves us with the number one album. Before we tackle this, I just wanted to thank you for coming back on. I think this has been four or five times, and I always appreciate your presence.
I think so. It's a pleasure. I always like doing it every year, Andy.
Awesome. And, if they want to find out more, follow him on Twitter, Sterlewine, Sterlewin. And that'll take you to your blog spot. That'll take you, you tweet out most of your reviews, most of your writing, right?
Some of it, not all of it, but there's a fair amount that goes out.
And on Facebook, do you add everybody, or just music fans? Do you have a public page? How do they go about that? Because your Facebook is like quite a discussion about music. It's one of my favorite things to read, actually. It's quite a nice debate always on your Facebook wall.
Yeah, it is fun, because there's colleagues, friends, and fans all go back and forth, and I really enjoy that. It's basically public. You can all easily follow. Since I get spammed with a lot of friends, it might take me a while to add friends, but I think you can follow my posts even if you're not explicitly friended.
Very cool. So Stephen Thomas Erlewin on Facebook and Sterlewin on Twitter. And that brings me – or how about your number one? I already saw what it is. Educate me because I'm not too familiar with it.
Okay. My number one is Maren Morris's Hero, which she's a country singer. And what I like about the record is that it feels completely modern. It pulls from rock and hip-hop and – definitely country without sounding explicitly like a country record. To me, it moves more towards pop, and I think that she's a sharp songwriter, great melodies. I like the themes that she plays around with. I like how My Church is basically about the power of the radio. Rich is a really funny song. 80s Mercedes is kind of has a melancholy undercurrent to it. Live, she needs some work. I've seen her once this year, and I was a little disappointed, but as an album, it works really well.
How does it stack up to the Miranda Lambert double album?
I listened to it more because I got a copy of it in April, so it's the record that I lived with the longest.
Sure.
But Miranda has gone up to number four for me because that's a really rich double album with a lot of things to sink your teeth into. And, Miranda is very different. That's a moody, murky one, and that's worth your time.
Investing some time in. Very cool. All right, so that brings me to my number one album of 2016. You have to be able to guess it by now. David Bowie's Black Star. Got it the Friday before it came out and was blown away, then blown away by the news. Even if he didn't pass away, this would definitely be high up there. It's succinct and it's sprawling at the same time, which is very, very hard to pull off. An epic 7-song album is definitely a task to be able to do that. But the first song alone, Black Star, 10 minutes of a jazz, dark, gothic entry into his catalog, and going all the way to I Can't Give Everything Away. What a great way to end the album. What a beautiful coda. It's Bowie, but it's something completely new at the same time. You could tell he was playing around or hearing a lot of urban sounds like Kendrick Lamar, but trying new things, constantly changing his sound even up until the final recording, right?
Yeah, I liked it the next day, but Black Star already is a much fuller and realized record. It's interesting how it's informed by jazz and hip hop to an extent without ever sounding like that, and it's very emotional. But for me, even after his death, it doesn't necessarily feel like a heavy record. It feels like it's
approachable.
Coming
yeah.
to turn. It's right. And also it's, there's sadness, but it's not like crushing grief. It's like, I find it inspirational that he chose to use his final years making art in the way that he always made art, and just really engaging through art. And I think that you can feel the same thing by engaging with the artwork.
That's very true. And my review I wrote right when I got the album the week earlier. And it's funny. I said at his age, he could easily do the Great American Songbook like Rod Stewart and belt out the
yep.
classics and get a paycheck. But no, he's constantly finding new ways to express himself. And, you know, 'Tis a Pity She Was a Whore is just a really dark entry thing to his, almost mm-hmm. sounds like his album Outside. And Girl Loves Me, he's got a slamming beat. He tries tons of different stuff in a mere 7 songs. So this is a great swan song, great number one album of the year. Weird year. I hope 2017 is a little bit more positive and will be
Agreed.
Interesting to stay up on all the different changes of the music industry, and I'm glad that you came along for the ride, Tom.
Anytime. Hopefully you can do this next year as well.
All right, sounds good. And on behalf of Stephen Thomas Erlewin, this is Andy signing off for the Andy Derer Show. Be sure to follow Andy on Twitter. That's at Andy Darer. And like our show on Facebook. That's facebook.com/TheAndyDarerShow. Videos at youtube.com/AndrewMartinDarer. And we're on iTunes. Just search The Andy Darer Show. Please leave a review. Thanks so much to our wonderful sponsors, Uncle Bub's award-winning barbecue, Record Utopia, The Mandrake, and Amazon.com. Theme song courtesy of Rich Banks Music. Thank you so much for checking out The Andy Darer Show. AndyDarer.com.